Today at Reader's Corner, Arlie Russell Hochschild, author of Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For all the attempts to understand the state of American politics and the blue-red divide, have we ignored what economic and cultural loss has done to pride? What happens when people in a hard-hit region suffer a deep loss of pride and are confronted with a powerful political appeal that makes it feel stolen? In her latest book, Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Radical Right, Arlie Hochschild studied Eastern Kentucky and focused on a demographic sweep in this shifting political landscape. Blue-collar men in small churches, roadside diners, trailer parks, and Narcotics Anonymous, she introduces us to unforgettable people, offering a lens through which to see them and the wider world. And she even maps a way forward. Arlie Hochschild is the author of The Second Shift, The Managed Heart, and Strangers in Their Own Land, which became an instant bestseller and was a finalist for a National Book Award. She is Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. Arlie Hochschild, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, the subtitle of your book, Arlie, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right, could have taken you to any number of states and counties. How'd you wind up in, and I'll say it the way they say it in Pikeville first, Pockville, okay? Or how'd you wind up in Pikeville, and why the major focus on men? Tell us about Pikeville.
Pikeville is a hub town in Kentucky 5, which is a congressional district in Appalachia in eastern Kentucky, which is the whitest and the second poorest in the whole country. And I got there sort of by wandering around on another project. It was about learning how to do jobs, how to code cell phone apps. And it was getting unemployed coal miners jobs from Silicon Valley. And so I was interested in how you could get jobs from California in a district run by a Democratic senator to cooperate with a district in eastern Kentucky where you had unemployed people, how you could get jobs from one area to the other and cooperate across the political divide. And this was an interest in that got me to eastern Kentucky. And then once I was there, I began to see a whole story unfold.
Well, tell me, I read about the fact that these Silicon Valley guys would decide they could bring their craft to eastern Kentucky, to Pikeville in particular. And basically, it's retired coal miners who then are trying to find a new way of life, and that's it. Has that worked? Is there really a going economy today in Pikeville, if not eastern Kentucky, when it comes to giving these retired miners new jobs as coders?
For some, it didn't scale up.
I see.
In a way that we hoped it would.
Uh-huh.
There is a coding training for ex-miners in Pikeville, and there was another outfit out of Louisville called InterApt, and it was students from that who were born in and lived in eastern Kentucky that I followed. Unfortunately, it didn't grow to full scale.
So how has the politics of eastern Kentucky changed over the last 30 years? You spend a little bit of time helping the reader understand that once upon a time, the political views of these folks were very different than they are today.
Yes, these are people that whose grandfathers and great-grandfathers used to be FDR New Deal Democrats, 80% in this congressional district, Kentucky 5, voted for Bill Clinton in 1996, but who voted in both 2016 and 2020, 80% for Donald Trump. And it was that which brought me to Pike County. And it was how that made sense to people. That's what I was wondering. Why here? Why now? And And how do emotions fit into this story? And there's in Proverbs, there's a saying, without wood, there is no fire. So we see in the news every day fiery, angry rhetoric on the right and far right, and half the country feeling very impelled to follow this and find it made sense to them, it satisfied them. So you could say this is a book about the wood, about the kindling.
Right.
We see Donald Trump with the match, but and Trump will come and go. There will be another Trump, but there is, without him, a kind of a Trumpism, a kind of a vulnerability to that rhetoric. And I wanted to understand that.
You talk about the material economy and the pride economy, and I want to get to the pride economy in a moment. But when it comes to the material economy, is it all about coal miners being thrown out of work? Are there other small factories that have shut down thanks to NAFTA or China's admission to the World Trade Organization? What accounts for all the job loss? Again, I think most of us think, well, it's all about coal mines.
Right, it's not. There's a local story and there's a national story. And I focus on the local story of a lost coal mines and lost jobs because it exaggerates a national story. What we're really looking at here on the national level is the 42% of Americans who are white and without a BA degree. And if you look at that 42%, based on research that's been done by Raj Chetty at Harvard, there's been a decline because of offshoring and automation in especially in red states, an economic decline over the last 3 months. Looking at the material economy, we can see that from the 1970s onward, there were kind of the haves and the have-nots of globalization. And the haves turned out to be in the blue states, more urban, with more recent and better equipped companies that were more resistant to offshoring and automation. And red states that were less so. So the result is that those in largely rural, semi-rural areas of the country sank economically, both absolutely and relatively in their income and their opportunity and number of other social indices. Higher proportion said they were in poor health, lived alone, and there are more so-called diseases of despair, suicide and alcoholism and drug addiction. So it's a sector that looked left and right. It saw Blacks improving, Blacks who had previously been far poorer than they, but who were improving from where they had been, and whites with BAs were also doing well. So they looked left and right and said, well, what about us? So that's the material economy. It's one of loss. And I think there are kind of three kinds of loss. And I'm trying to look at this psychologically, socially, psychologically, because this loss is an economic matter, but it's also an emotional matter. There's the loss, you had a job and now you don't. And you may have to move to where you can get another job. So you lose your home, your neighborhood, your sense of position where you are. And there's also a devaluation of what you know and the moral qualities that were called for to do your job. So a lot of people who really knew the inside of a coal mine brilliantly, you know, where you could get hurt, where not. And had a lot of local knowledge, useful. It's often said, oh, hillbilly can fix anything. You know, the refrigerator repairman isn't going to make it up the tiny one lane road to your home, and so you fix whatever gets broken. So a lot of local knowledge that mattered and was useful, and it doesn't matter anymore. There's that second kind of loss of devaluation, and then there's this third kind of loss. Looks like people in other regions are doing a lot better than you. Why is that? So it turns out loss is a big part of this story. It's part of the economic story, but we've only begun to unravel the whole meaning of this story. When we look at the economic side, we have to look at how it makes you feel to be in that state. And that is kind of getting at the wood that can be to which a lit match could be set.
Yes, I think you were quoting one man in particular, Alex Hughes, who described losing his job as worse than being the victim of a violent stabbing. I mean, I think that pretty much sums up what you're saying here.
Yes, that's right.
Today I'm speaking with Arlie Russell Hochschild. She's the author of Stolen Pride, set in Eastern Kentucky. The book takes a hard look at life in Eastern Kentucky and what impact it has on the politics of the region. So let's talk about Ruth Mullins and John Rosenberg. Help us understand Eastern Kentucky, or at least a small part of Eastern Kentucky, from their vantage points.
Just to back up a bit, what I did is realize that in Pike County and Kentucky Five, there was a kind of a perfect storm. Coal jobs were going out, new jobs were not coming, and an opiate crisis was coming in. And then in 2017, there was a neo-Nazi white nationalist march coming to town. And I thought, oh no, this is a perfect storm. So what I did was think, okay, let me interview all parties to this. First, the neo-Nazi who was leading this march, then the city fathers who were trying to protect Pikeville from the violence that Homeland Security was telling them was about to occur. And then the people who could be hurt by this racist rhetoric. And so who that's African Americans living in there, permanent residents who've been there longer than a lot of whites who were coming from the South and as a stop way, midpoint in the great migration to the North. And then there I found a Holocaust survivor, a lawyer who had settled in the area, and then an imam that was running a small mosque. So these were people, minorities in the area, very settled. They felt very at home there. But they certainly didn't welcome a white nationalist march.
What was Pikeville's response to that march? How did it fare, I guess?
I interviewed people top, bottom, politically, side to side. What do you think about this? The people who are coming to town and what they're saying. And what I found, basically, this is perhaps a spoiler, is that they said no. No, look at our beautiful graveyards in these hills. In them are the graves of our grandfathers who fought in World War II and lost their lives there. So we don't want a rerun of Nazism in the United States. We value democracy here. So they said no, that was too extreme for them. But at the same time, Donald Trump came to town, and many people who were law and order people, they were conservative in their values, but they believed in fairness. They believed in democracy very strongly and in law and order. But after January 6th occurred, and then as the rhetoric of Trump escalated, and there was talk of Project 2025, when enemies might be rounded up, elements of the Constitution suspended. When people were told they wouldn't have to vote after 2024 election, and Donald Trump was inviting neo-Nazis to Mar-a-Lago, all of this, these people, they were, their candidate had gotten closer to the white nationalist march position, but they were still loyal to him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they themselves were not that extreme. Mm-hmm. The two candidates, oh, I should mention that the actual neo-Nazi, Matthew Heimbach, changed his mind. He said, I was wrong about racism. I'm really just talking about all working people. So while he softened his line, Trump hardened his.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So I mentioned Alex Jones a minute ago. And you draw an interesting comparison and contrast between him and Wyatt Blair. What are those similarities and differences, and how does it tell the full story?
Well, two very different people, and they're profiled in this book. I'm looking at how they look at the world, how they look at Matthew Heimbach and white nationalism, and how they look at Donald Trump and his Make America Great promises. And these two people look at the world in very different ways, although they came from circumstances that were quite similar. And what it shows is how individual each person is. You can't stereotype, you know, them at all. And I profile each of them, as I do others in the book, from the point of view of pride and shame. So you can see them as pride profiles. Alex Hughes, his grandfather had been injured in the coal mines and advised both his son, Alex's father, and Alex not to go into coal mining. But so Alex's father had been a long-haul truck driver, and Alex himself was seeking a similar kind of employment outside of mining. In a time in the 90s when jobs just were disappearing, and he didn't want to have to leave. He said, to leave, you need an education and money and contacts. I don't have any of those things, so I'm going to try and make it here. And he experienced what he experienced by applying to himself what I call a kind of code of ethics of bootstrap pride. And he tried very hard. I have to do it. I have to put in the work. I have to know what I'm doing. And if I do well, I can take credit. But if I fail, that's on me. That was the kind of a strict Protestant ethic kind of version of pride. So when he did find himself without work in the area, he blamed himself. So again, his basis of pride was working, and especially really solely to provide for his family. That's what he wanted desperately to be able to do. And in the end, he became a leaver, left town, and actually through this program, InterAPT, which trained people to know how to code and program cell phones. He got extremely good at it, moved to Louisville, and prospered. So his was a bootstrap ethic, and he actually became proud of what he did and succeeded. So by contrast, Wyatt, whom I met in a prisoner release program. He was a felon who was caught with some drug trafficking and other crimes. And he had what I would call a kind of bad boy concept of Right. In other words, his father had been KKK and he was inaugurated into the Klan and roughing people up. That wasn't bad. That was good. And in fact, in his interview, he kept saying, well, I was so bad, as if it were good, or I wasn't bad enough, as if the bad things he did weren't sufficiently bad. So being transgressive, pushing others around, all of that became a basis of pride, especially in prison. And he said he had a swastika on his back, and that when he wore his shirt off in the prison yard, you know, this would scare people away. He was quite a small man. So totally different subcultural view of, you know, what a good man is and what you have to do to be a proud man. And there were other bases of pride too. I mean, there could be pride just in surviving. Really, we think of pride as just based on your material circumstances, you know, you're rich, middle, poor. But people I came to know took pride, for example, in coping with poverty, the tremendous creativity it takes to actually live with very little. That became a basis of pride. Look, I made it anyway. And the meaning was in the anyway, what circumstances you had to surmount to seem like you weren't bothered by money.
And on the other side of pride is shame. And when you mentioned Alex Hughes taking off for Louisville because he gets a good job, meanwhile, there's a lot of folks back home who don't have that opportunity. And I think you draw the conclusion that actually is part of the shame factor in this community, in this region, where those who are left behind feel very badly of the fact that others left and they couldn't.
Yes. And that takes us to what I came to think of as the pride paradox. If we look at the whole country, what we find is that there are people in lucky economic growing circumstances and unlucky declining circumstances. That's the economic story. That's the material economy.
Right.
But we also live in cultures of pride. And what seemed to me tragic and paradoxical is that the people living in the downwardly mobile economies, the tougher economies where things are harder, much harder to succeed, generally fell to people with a tougher version of the Protestant ethic. That is, if I succeed, that's to my credit. And if I fail, that's on me too. And we find Republicans are much more likely to hew to this older version of the Protestant ethic, where this focuses on the individual, whereas people in the more prosperous economies, generally Democrats, tend to say, look, if I succeed, well, my circumstances were helping me and I'll take some credit. But if I fail, circumstances may have caused that and I'll take a little fault, but they have a role for circumstance, by which I mean, what social class were you born into? What race were you born into? What was the conditions of the economy in your region? Circumstance kind of entered into their allocation of pride and shame. So they were less self-shaming. So the people in red states had it hard in two ways. And that's the pride paradox.
So if you could wave a magic wand and do one thing that presidents over the last century have attempted to do or promised to do in eastern Kentucky, after you've been so close to the people, to the lives of blacks and whites, what would you suggest? Where do they go from here?
Well, first, you know, I would invite the policymakers to get on a bus and go to Eastern Kentucky, get an earful, And what I think they would hear is, look, we're ready for work. We want work. And we actually would be interested in solar panels on roofs and some of these sawed-off mountains. Couldn't they have windmills? They're not against alternative energy, the people I came to know. And that there are many kinds of white-collar jobs that could come to this area. So they want development, but what they also want is to not be looked down on. They spend a good deal, and they would tell you, of energy trying to fend off stereotypic thinking about them. So there could be, what I would do is listen to the voices of people in all rural areas, especially Eastern Kentucky. And I think what you'd hear is we need to be culturally respected as well as given economic opportunity.
You know, it did occur to me as I finished your book regarding this issue of rural policy that both of our presidential candidates have reached out to rural America, at least in a political sense, because they both chose people who come from rural America. As a matter of fact, one of them, J.D. Vance, wrote a book called Hillbilly Elegy from his experiences growing up with a family in eastern Kentucky. I don't know whether you've had a chance to read his book, but I'm just curious whether or not it had anything to do with your work or what how they might in Eastern Kentucky look at something like that.
I've met J.D. Vance, and yes, I have read Hillbilly Elegy. He actually had summers with his grandparents in Jackson, Kentucky. That's just a 40-minute drive from Pikeville. But a lot of people are ambivalent about him because that book, poignant as it is, A Boy's Experience Growing Up with an Addicted Mother, it kind of points to the solution as getting out, getting away, being the exception, reaching for the American dream by escape, and not by making the region, the circumstances that made it so hard, not going back to appreciating the region and rescuing it. And he has nothing to say, of course, about the public dollars it takes to get good addiction recovery centers where they're needed. So I think there's an ambivalence among those I talked to about Vance. He was scheduled to come to Pikeville, but canceled his trip because his airplane was too big to land in the Pikeville local
That sure
air.
tells the story of Pikeville. Well, we've run out of time, Arlie, but I've so much enjoyed this, and I do want to remind our listeners that if they're interested in my 2017 interview of J.D. Vance about his book, The Hillbilly Elegy, they can go onto the Boise State Public Radio website and just put in the search engine his name, and it popped up for me, and I'm sure it will pop up for them. This, of course, was a different J.D. Vance that we have in Before American Eyes today, but it is an interesting book, as you point out, about life in Eastern Kentucky. Arlie, thanks so much for joining us today. This has been a delight. Thanks for writing the book, Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right by Arlie Hochschild. And I think I can safely say that this book applies not just to Eastern Kentucky, but to rural America in general, and ought to be a real challenge for whoever gets elected president in November. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.